In 2009, a French electronica artist by the name of David Grier, I think. Yeah, Tom's giving me the nod of affirmation. He recorded a song with another group called Electric Youth. It was titled Real Hero. The song garnered a lot of attention 2 years later when it debuted on the motion picture soundtrack to the movie Drive. I see two people, like both looking at each other. These two guys just went like this. So apparently they know the movie, starring Ryan Gosling. And man, I could describe this song to you and how it oozes with 80s synth and how it exudes all things 80s, but I'm not really a musician. And thankfully with technology, I can just play a sample of the song for you guys. So that's what I'd like to do right now, is play a sample. I love the lyrics of that song. A real human being and a real hero. Back against the wall and odds with the strength of a will and a cause. Your pursuits are called outstanding. You're emotionally complex. Against the grain of dystopic claims, not the thoughts your actions entertain. And you have proved to be a real human being and a real hero. Austin Garrick from Electric Youth, he talks about this song and he says that the lyrics for the chorus came from his grandfather, who was really impressed with Captain Soli Solinger, the U.S. Airways pilot who landed his plane in the middle of the Hudson a few years ago. And he saved over 150 people on board. He said his grandfather, in talking to him, was so enthralled with Solinger and what he had done there that he kept walking around the house and saying, he's a real human being and a real hero. And Garrick said that he had to put that into a song. Grier, on the other hand, from the band College, who collaborated with him, he said, quote, I wanted to give a homage to that lonely hero that we see in movies like Mad Max. People who make their own choice and try to save lives. I love what Garrick's grandfather said. A real human being and a real hero. I love also how Greer describes it and says that they make their own choice and try to save lives. For me, my heroes are not Batman or Superman. You can't find them in a Marvel action comic book. I think my heroes are real human beings. And I think that's what makes them real heroes, is that they're real human beings. In our passage tonight, I want us to see Jesus. I want us to read through this, and I want us to see Jesus, a real human being and a real hero. Hebrews 2:14 says this, "Since therefore the children share in flesh and blood, he, that is Jesus, himself likewise partook of the same things." The commentator J. Harold Greenlee, in commenting on this passage, he says, "What is implied by the phrase flesh and blood? It refers to mankind's whole physical and sensuous nature, to the fragility of mankind. And what is meant by likewise? It indicates general similarity. It means in the same manner and reality, not in mere appearance. It means in absolutely the same manner." So what the author of Hebrews is getting at here in this passage is that Jesus Christ is a real human being. And not merely in appearance, so that he just looked like a human and then was able to do supernatural things, but that he was fully human. That in flesh and blood, he embodied all of what it means to be human, including all of humanity's fragility. I say that right now because as we enter into our text tonight and we read through, if we diminish at all the reality of Jesus' full humanity, then we will inevitably diminish our worship of him. And we'll diminish our worship of the cross and what we're about to read. So tonight, let's read. And I hope as we read, we see a real human being and a real hero. Matthew 26, verse 31. "Then Jesus said to them, 'You will all fall away because of me this night. For it is written, I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. But after I am raised up, I will go before you to Galilee.' Peter answered him, 'Though they all fall away because of you, I will never fall away.' Jesus said to him, 'Truly I tell you, this very night, before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times.' Peter said to him, 'Even if I must die with you, I will not deny you.' And all the disciples said the same." Jesus has just got done instituting the Lord's Supper, and he's on his way to the Mount of Olives, and he takes his crew of disciples with him. And as he's walking with his disciples, he says to them, he says, "You are all going to fall away tonight because of me. For it is written, strike the shepherd and the sheep of the flock will scatter." He's quoting from Zechariah, chapter 17, verse 7. Jesus is painting himself as the shepherd. He puts himself in that verse as the shepherd who is struck down. And he follows this quote with a surprising statement that furthers his role as a shepherd. He says, "But after I am raised up, I will go before you to Galilee. I think this verse right here, it reveals Jesus' strong loyalty and commitment to his relationship with the disciples. It reveals Jesus' strong loyalty and commitment to his church. It's a statement of forgiveness that he makes right here. He's offering forgiveness already before anything has happened. And it's a statement that Peter himself apparently didn't hear. Because we read about Peter's response here, right? Verse 33. Though they all fall away because of you, I will never fall away. Peter heard failure in Jesus' comments. He heard what Jesus said, and what he took from that was failure. He heard failure because, like so many of us, to quote the commentator Frederick Bruner, Peter was placing his discipleship on the foundation of dedication rather than forgiveness. In theology, this is called perfectionism. It's all about performance and what you do. It's what the author David Brooks, in his New York Times best-selling book, The Road to Character, what he calls a resume virtue. A resume virtue is a virtue that you place on your resume. Their job skills, their external successes. And in his book, Brooks borrows from Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, who argues that there are two types of nature in humanity. He calls this Adam 1 and Adam 2. Adam 1 is the career-oriented, ambitious side of our nature. Build, create, do things. Adam 1 wants to have high status and win victories. Adam 1 wants to conquer the world around him. He wants to savor in his accomplishments. Adam 1's motto is success. His logic, Brooks says, is utilitarian and economic. Input leads to output. Effort equals reward. Maximize your utility. Impress the world around you. That's Peter in this moment right here. He wants to impress the world around him. His motto is success, and when he hears Jesus' words, he hears failure, not success. Which he's right. It's not success to deny Jesus and to scatter about. But because Peter is so consumed with not being a failure, he fails to hear the forgiveness that is being extended to him in Jesus' words here. I think this is us today. To quote Brooks once again, he says, "We live in a culture that nurtures Adam 1, the external. We live in a society that encourages us to think about how to have a great career, but leaves many of us inarticulate about how to cultivate the inner life. The competition to succeed and win admiration is so fierce it becomes all-consuming. A consumer marketplace encourages us to live by a utilitarian calculus, to satisfy our desires and lose sight of the moral stakes involved in everyday decisions. The noise of the fast and shallow communication makes it harder to hear the quieter sounds that emanate from the depths. We live in a culture that teaches us to promote and advertise ourselves and to master the skills required for success. Brooks is saying we're all self-promoters. And I think he's right. I mean, the only reason why Peter's words bum us out so much is because they sound so familiar. Brooks, in his book, he does a great job of putting his finger on the ethos of our culture today. And he says the ethos of this can be seen in our social media. Everyone is encouraged to have a personal brand, to be a self-promoter on some scale, no matter how large or small the following, to promote the self. And I think he's right. Because, I mean, think about it. Think about the last picture we posted to Instagram. Why did we do it? What was the purpose? We just had to share it with the rest of the world? Why? To what end? For self-promotion. I think if we really want to see how this hyper-competitive culture and this culture of self-promotion is affecting us today, I think we don't need to look at ourselves. I think we need to look at the generation after us. The younger generation coming up. This American Life did an episode recently called Status Update. It aired in, I think, November 27th, 2015. Guys, how many of you listened to This American Life? Oh, it's awesome. Yeah, Sheila, thank you. I appreciate that. Man, this episode, go back and listen to it. It opens up, and the introduction in Act 1 are three ninth grade girls talking about the intricacies of Instagram and posting pictures to Instagram. And they have a really casual, nonchalant, normal conversation with Ira Glass that is both fascinating and terrifying all at the same time. I mean, it's incredible. They go into detail and they're talking about the anxieties that occur leading up to posting a photo on Instagram. They talk about what it feels like when they don't receive likes within the first 5 minutes of the picture being posted. They go into more detail talking to Ira Glass about the screening process. This is a real thing right now. They screen all of their photos before they go on to Instagram. And by screening, what they mean is they take the photo, they filter it out, and then before they post it to Instagram, they pass it around and they send it via text message to a small, close group of friends. And those friends then tell them, oh, that's a good photo. You should post that. I'll comment on that. I'll totally like that. That's good. And the reason why they do this, is because they say if you post a bad photo to Instagram, what will happen is someone will take a screenshot of that photo and then they'll text it around to all of their friends and they'll say all sorts of nasty comments about you behind your back. self-promotion, hyper-competition and competitiveness. This is the world of normal for a ninth grade girl growing up in America. And for many of us, we're shaking our heads and we're just thinking to ourselves, oh my gosh, I am so grateful that I am not in ninth grade anymore. That sounds like a horrific life. And what we fail to see is that that horrific life is what an entire generation is beginning to call normal. See, here's the problem with Adam 1 and living a life like Adam 1. It's shallow, it's self-indulged, it lacks real commitment. Because as soon as something is not useful or in our self-interest, we're over it. We're done with it. As soon as it doesn't benefit us, we're gone. Life is about consuming the world around us and conquering it. And that bleeds over into our relationships. People no longer have personhood. They are means to whatever our end is, which generally revolves around however we define success in our life. And that life leads to constant anxiety, constant anger, envy, pride, depression, even in the midst of the most trouble-free of circumstances. A life built on resume virtues is a life that will absolutely crumble in the midst of adversity. And so Peter will fail. We know the story. He'll deny Jesus 3 times. Because his definition of what a successful Messiah is a Messiah that overthrows Rome, not a Messiah that is crucified by Rome. Jesus is a means to Peter and the rest of the disciples' ends. This is why they fail to recognize the significance of Jesus' anointing at Bethany previously in this chapter. And this is why they fail to be with Jesus in his greatest time of need. Verse 36. Then Jesus went with them to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to his disciples, "Sit here while I go over there and pray." And taking with him Peter and the 2 sons of Zebedee, he began to be sorrowful and troubled. Then he said to them, "My soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch with me." And going a little further, he fell on his face and prayed, saying, "My Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will." And he came to the disciples and found them sleeping. And he said to Peter, "So could you not watch with me 1 hour? Watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak." Again, for the second time, he went away and prayed, "My Father, if this cannot pass unless I drink it, your will be done." And again, he came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were heavy. So leaving them again, he went away and prayed for the third time, saying the same words again. Then he came to the disciples and said to them, Sleep and take your rest later on. See, the hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand. Jesus heads to the Garden of Gethsemane to pray. He heads to the garden because, like any human being, he is experiencing sorrow and trouble. And in his own words, he's experiencing, quote, sorrow to the point of death. What Jesus needs in this moment is friendship and community. Deep, personal, intimate relationship. And he invites three of his disciples to enter into that with him. He invites them by inviting them to pray with him. And then he shares his honest feelings. Did you notice that? He shares his honest feelings with his friends and with the Father. Why is Jesus so sorrowful? Why is he so troubled? The cross. I think Jesus is beginning to feel some of the weight of the cross. Namely, I think Jesus is beginning to see a glimpse of what relational separation from the Father is going to be like as a result of the sins of the world being cast on him. And I think what Jesus sees in that glimpse is terrifying to him. I think it brings deep sorrow to him, sorrow to the point of death. And I think he is feeling alone. And because he feels alone, he's inviting those closest to him, those around him, to enter into that with him because he doesn't want to be alone. He doesn't want to feel that. And he goes a little bit further in verse 39. What does Jesus pray for? He asks that this cup would pass. What is this cup? It's a weird phrase. It's the cup of God's right judgment and wrath upon sin. What is Jesus asking for? What is he asking for in this moment? He's asking not to go to the cross. Jesus is asking not to go to the cross. Is this a good request or a bad request? Seriously, is this a good request or a bad request? I tend to think it's a horrible request, personally. I mean, I'll play that scenario out. Like, the Father answers that prayer. No new covenant. No forgiveness of sin for the entire world. Still in the sacrificial system. This is a bad request, personally. I read this and I'm like, oh my goodness. Whoa. It's mind-melting. If I stop and think about this any longer, I get really terrified sometimes. But what is Jesus doing? Why is he making what I think is such a bad request? I think he's sharing his honest desire with the Father. And what Jesus desires What Jesus really desires in this moment is he really desires not to go to the cross. He really desires not to experience relational separation from the Father. So Jesus has just poured out his honest feelings, given his honest desires. He's being incredibly emotionally vulnerable. And where are his three closest friends? They're asleep. If you're Jesus right now in this moment, how are you feeling? I know how I'm feeling. I'm feeling pretty let down. I'm feeling really alone. And I think that's what Jesus is feeling too, because what does he say? He says, you couldn't watch with me 1 hour? Watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. Verse 42, and again, Jesus goes out and he prays, although this time he says, my Father, if this cannot pass unless I drink it, your will be done. And it's here, right here in this prayer, that I think Jesus shares his honest trust with the Father. This is a portrait of true submission. True submission, which shares its honest feelings. A person shares their honest, deep down feelings. They share their honest desires. And then if those are heard and listened and received, they share their trust. I keep hearing music going on back here. I don't know what's going on. Submission nowadays in our culture, submission is, it's a naughty word. You can't say submission in our culture today. You guys realize that? Because to submit yourself to someone or something outside of yourself, it means that you're being, quote, not authentic. You know that? You're not being true to yourself. Why? Because you're not being true to your feelings, to your desires, and therefore you're not being authentic. This is because in our culture and our society, today, being a holistic human being does not mean coming in contact with a moral God external to ourselves. It means finding the source of good from one's inner depth. So to be truly authentic, the individual must first reflect on oneself and understand who they really are. And then they proceed to interpret that and their understanding out to the world around them. This way of thinking is born out of an Enlightenment thought. It comes from guys like René Descartes and John Locke, who believed that a person's free will precedes the social obligations a person has. This leads to a morality that's anchored in sentiment. Morality has an inner voice. For authenticity, the inner voice is considered fundamental. This is because it tells the individual what the right thing to do is. So we make statements now, the most casual of statements that are no longer, I think that movie was kind of bad. We make statements like this. I feel like that movie was bad. Oh, I just feel like these shoes don't really go with this outfit. I don't know what's going on. The source of truth is now the inner self and the emotions. And so truth is no longer objective. It's no longer rooted outside of the self. It's subjective and rooted within. So to each his own, that's true for you, but it's not really true for me. Do what makes you feel right. Truth is about finding harmony within yourself. Do whatever it takes to experience inner depth and self-actualization and self-realization. Realize the self. Do yoga, deep breathing meditation exercises. Look within. Happiness is within you. Discover who you uniquely are. And then express that to the world around you in only a way that you can. Be you. It's all about self. It's all about having healthy self-esteem. Make sure you have healthy self-image. It's shallow. It's isolated. It's lonely. Because the deepest you can go is yourself. So how do you have healthy self-esteem? Well, you root your identity in yourself. That's how you have healthy self-esteem. And so what we do is we perform to our self-made standards. So if our identity is in our physical appearance, then our self-esteem will be based on however we look that day. So if we didn't meet our self-set standards for dieting and exercising, then that day we will appear tainted. We'll have low self-esteem because we weren't authentic to ourselves. We did things that conflicted with ourselves emotionally inside. If our identity is rooted in our accomplishments, then our self-esteem will be based on whether or not we accomplished enough that day. It's lonely and it's isolating because whether we realize it or not, we're competing with everyone around us. Walk into a room, see someone. They have now become a potential enemy, a potential threat, someone to compete with. They could be doing it better than us. And so we have to keep people at a distance. We have to show no weakness at all, no vulnerability, and we remain isolated. Lonely individuals. It's comparison from a distance. It's competition continually. It's resume virtue. It's all about performance and success, however you define success for yourself. Submission is not an option. With this view, submission is in fact the enemy in this view. It would mean giving up control to someone or something outside of ourselves. And we can't do that today in our culture. To do that would be to fail to succeed by accomplishing our own authentic way of being human. If we fail to do so, we would lose our whole reason and scope for life, assuming that the purpose of life is to be authentic to yourself. The philosopher Charles Taylor says this mindset has shifted the whole moral horizon for life. In it, the individual has lost something essential. The individual has lost the heroic dimension of life. We've lost the sense of higher purpose, the purpose of something worth dying for. But that's not the way that Jesus views the world in this passage, is it? Seems like Jesus has a different perspective. Seems like in the garden, Jesus is seeing things a different way. Because what does he do? He submits. He submits himself to the Father. Now, I could just go forward from here and say that this is the way forward. This is it. Submit yourself. When the trials of life come along, when the pains and the struggles of life happen, just submit yourself to Christianity and the Christian ethic, and everything will be okay. And all that would be is just a disguise of some other self-actualization with a little bit of Christianese sprinkled on top. If I were to do that with this sermon, I would be a horrible pastor. Because I don't think the purpose of this passage is to just get us to submit. I think the purpose of this passage here is to show us relationship. Because good, true, healthy submission, it doesn't happen without healthy relationship. Because when I read this account here, when I read Jesus in the garden, and when I was studying this, the only question I had to Jesus, and the only question that I kept asking myself time and time again, was how? How? Jesus, how? How did you do it? How could you submit yourself to the Father? How could you give your full trust to the Father? How could you do it? Even after you share your honest feelings, even after you share your honest desires, how could you do it, Jesus? Especially when the Father says no. I think the only way that Jesus did this was through relationship. Through close, personal, intimate relationship with the Father. I think that relationship was the bedrock for trust. I like what Dr. Gary Brashear says about trust. He says, quote, trust is the willingness to risk being vulnerable based upon positive expectations of the intentions or behavior of another. Why was Jesus willing to risk being vulnerable in the garden? Why was he willing to throw himself out there to the Father? I think it's because Jesus had a positive expectation. I think he had a positive expectation of the intentions and the behavior of the Father. And the reason I say this is because of verse 30. in Matthew 26. Then Jesus went with them. Oh, that's 36. And when they had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. Many commentators believe that the hymn that they sung that night at the end of the Passover meal was a hymn that Jews sing at the end of every Passover meal. It's a hymn recorded in the book of Psalms. It's Psalm 118. Oh, give thanks to the Lord, for he is good. For his steadfast love endures forever. Let Israel say, his steadfast love endures forever. Let the house of Aaron say, his steadfast love endures forever. Let those who fear the Lord say, his steadfast love endures forever. Out of my distress, I called on the Lord. The Lord answered me and set me free. The Lord is on my side. I will not fear. What can man do to me? The Lord is on my side as my helper. I shall look in triumph on those who hate me. It is better to take refuge in the Lord than to trust in man. It is better to take refuge in the Lord than to trust in princes. All nations surrounded me. In the name of the Lord, I cut them off. They surrounded me on every side. In the name of the Lord, I cut them off. They surrounded me like bees. They went out like a fire among thorns. In the name of the Lord, I cut them off. I was pushed hard so that I was falling, but the Lord helped me. The Lord is my strength and my song. He has become my salvation. Glad songs of salvation are in the tents of the righteous. The right hand of the Lord does valiantly. The right hand of the Lord exalts. The right hand of the Lord does valiantly. I shall not die, but I shall live and recount the deeds of the Lord. The Lord has disciplined me severely, but he has not given me over to death. Open to me the gates of righteousness that I may enter through them and give thanks to the Lord. This is the gate of the Lord. The righteous shall enter through it. I thank you that you have answered me and have become my salvation. The stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. This is the Lord's doing. It is marvelous in our eyes. This is the Lord, the day that the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. Save us, we pray, O Lord. O Lord, we pray, give us success. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. We bless you from the house of the Lord. The Lord is God, and he has made his light to shine upon us. Bind this festal sacrifice with cords up to the horns of the altar. You are my God, and I will give thanks to you. You are my God, I will extol you. Oh, give thanks to the Lord, for he is good, for his steadfast love endures forever. Oh, give thanks to the Lord, for he is good. His steadfast love endures forever. I think Jesus submitted himself to the Father because he experienced that hymn and he believed it. I think that's why the author of Hebrews says, quote, in the days of his flesh, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death, and he was heard because of his reverence. Although he was a son, he learned obedience through what he suffered. Trust isn't binary. It's not put in this and then out comes full trust. Trust is analog, it's incremental. Trust is earned over time. Which is why if we diminish Jesus' Christ's humanity and downplay all of his life to just being God, then we absolutely take trust out of the picture. We remove choice from the equation. Jesus learned obedience through what he suffered. His obedience was incremental. It was developed over time and through much suffering. And what did Jesus suffer? I think Jesus suffered all of his life. I mean, don't get me wrong. I think Jesus totally knew how to have a good time. But as Isaiah says, he was a man of sorrow, acquainted with grief. I think Jesus died 1,000 little deaths to himself before he ever died on the cross. I think every day Jesus woke up and died to himself so that he might do, quote, the will of him who sent me. I mean, just imagine how much Jesus suffered on a regular basis throughout his life. Take just this chapter alone here. At the beginning of this chapter, Jesus is in a room with his closest friends, and only a woman named Miriam recognizes the occasion enough to anoint him and to pour perfume over his head and to prepare him for his death. Can you imagine how alone Jesus must have felt in that moment in that crowded room, looking at all of his friends as they look around bewildered by what this woman is doing? The next scene is Jesus predicting his death and then looking his betrayer, Judas, in the eyes and sharing a meal with him. He shared a meal with him. Then after he predicts his death, he walks around with his closest friends and they all tell him he doesn't know what he's talking about. That they're not going to deny him. They're not going to abandon him in his greatest time of need. I think Jesus suffered every day of his life. And it's only after those experiences in chapter 26, it's only after those do we actually read the garden. That's when we read about his closest friends falling asleep. That's when we read about the weight of the cross hanging on his shoulders. And at any time, Jesus knew he could pull the plug. But he submitted himself to the Father and to the Father's will. I think Jesus died 1,000 deaths to himself before he ever died on the cross. And the whole time he was doing that, he was learning obedience through what he suffered, learning how to obey, how to trust, and then obey. He knows how hard it is to trust. He knows how hard it is to obey. I think that's what makes him all the more heroic and incredible. He's a real human being who made the choice to save lives at the expense of his own. I think many of us, we resist turning to Jesus because we feel like he can't relate to us. Fully God, fully man. Probably more God than man is how we think about it in our heads. And so we think, oh, he doesn't really get it. He doesn't know what it's like to obey. He doesn't know what it's like, how I feel right now. But I would submit to you that Jesus can relate to you far better than any other human being in this room. I mean, think about it. In a violent storm, what tree is the one that knows the full weight of the storm? The tree that falls down in the middle of the storm, or the tree that endures the entirety of the storm? Guys, we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with us in our weaknesses. We have one who was tempted in every way, just as we are, and yet without sin. Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in the time of need. Hebrews 4:15-16. My question to us tonight is, are we drawing near to the throne of grace? Are we looking at our high priest? Are we walking with Jesus tonight in personal, intimate, deep relationship? A relationship where we share our honest feelings with him. A relationship where we share our honest desires with him. And a relationship where we share our honest trust with him. Are we walking in relationship with him?